This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique tells a story, and what a story it is. Here's how he himself explained it. An artist, gifted with a vivid imagination, falls in love with a woman who embodies the ideal of beauty and fascination that he has long been seeking. He imagines that there is some hope. He believes himself loved. Later, in a fit of despair, he poisons himself with opium, but the narcotic, instead of killing him, induces a horrible vision in which he believes that, having murdered his beloved, he is condemned to death and witnesses his own execution. After death, he sees himself surrounded by a foul assembly of sorcerers and devils. His beloved is now only a prostitute, fit to take part in such an orgy. End quote. Now, the Symphonie Fantastique is not just the most famous opium dream in music history. It's a groundbreaking work that shattered structural, instrumental, and programmatic barriers. It is, in itself, a musical revolution. At a time when artists felt freer than ever before to express their passions, Berlioz expanded his art in ways that other musicians of his time could not have imagined. He found new orchestral colors and discovered ways to extract new sounds from instruments that had existed since the time of the first orchestras. And yet, the Symphonie Fantastique is revolution grounded in tradition, for it is as firmly built a piece of musical architecture as a symphony by Berlioz's idol, Beethoven. On September 11, 1827, Berlioz had gone to the Paris Odeon for a performance of Hamlet by a company from London. It was a distinguished group which included some of the most renowned actors on the English stage. The younger female roles were taken by a young Irish actress named Harriet Smithson, and Berlioz fell instantly and wildly in love with her. Even though he spoke next to no English at that point, he wrote to her repeatedly, but she ignored his letters. He heard gossip about an affair between her and her manager, which hurt him, but also provided for a moment enough distance to enable him to plan and begin work on the Symphonie Fantastique. The premiere of the Fantastique took place on December 5, 1830. At this point, Berlioz had put Harriet aside for one Marie-Félicité Denise Moch, who called herself Camille. An outstandingly gifted pianist with no conscience and no heart, she was 19 when Berlioz fell in love with her, and they exchanged rings. But Berlioz had just won the Prix de Rome, which meant he had to move to Italy. After a long and disturbing period without news from Camille, he received a letter from her mother announcing the young woman's engagement to the pianist and piano manufacturer Camille Pleyel. Berlioz, the quintessential romantic, decided to kill both Camilles, Madame Moch, and then himself. He disguised himself as a lady's maid, scribbled some instructions about the Fantastique to a conductor friend, and set out on the next train. On the way, he had second and maybe third thoughts, especially after realizing he had left his costume on an earlier train. He wrote a letter asking to be readmitted to the Academy at Rome and received a friendly, sympathetic, paternal reply from the Academy's director. He then spent three more happy weeks at Nice composing his King Lear overture and returned to Rome and his symphony. Two years later, having completed his obligation to the Academy, Berlioz was ready to present a newly sharpened and improved version of his symphony. Miss Smithson was in Paris again, this time overseeing a much less successful season. She was persuaded to attend Berlioz's concert that December, though it seems she went without realizing the nature of the event or the identity of the composer. And on the morning of the premiere, Berlioz and Smithson finally met. Before long, Harriet had pronounced the fatal Berlioz, je t'aime, and they were married. But it was immediately clear that the whole business was a disaster. They separated in the summer of 1844 and should have done so much sooner. Harriet, who already had a reputation for a temper, had had an accident that had put an end to her career. She'd become an alcoholic and was eventually paralyzed by a series of strokes. But even though Berlioz had long since left her for another woman, he paid to have her attended night and day and visited her almost daily until her death. Berlioz wrote several programs for this autobiographical and in every way fantastic symphony of his, and the differences between them can be seen as a barometer of his changing feelings for Harriet. When the score was published in 1845, Berlioz wrote that a description was indispensable for a complete understanding of the dramatic outline of the work, but that it should be thought of like the spoken text of an opera, serving to introduce the musical movements, various situations in the life of an artist. Here is how Berlioz described the opening. Part 1, Reveries, Passions. The author imagines that a young musician sees for the first time a woman who embodies all the charms of the ideal being of whom he has dreamed, and he falls hopelessly in love with her. Through a bizarre trick of fancy, the beloved image always appears in the mind's eye of the artist, linked to a musical thought, whose character, passionate but also noble and reticent, he finds similar to the one he attributes to his beloved. End quote. One of Berlioz's most extraordinary innovations in this symphony is what he called the idée fixe, a recurring theme identified with a character in the drama. Berlioz was not the first to make use of this idea, but he made the clearest and most extensive use of it, paving the way for Wagner's leitmotifs and the tone poems of Liszt, Strauss, and so many more. Right from the start, Berlioz announces that this will be no ordinary symphony, with unconventional instrumental effects that turn standard notions of what belonged in a symphony on their heads. Berlioz takes his time setting the scene. It's almost 6 minutes into the symphony before the beloved makes her first appearance. Back to Berlioz's description. The melodic image and its human model pursue him incessantly, like a double idée fixe. This is the reason for the constant appearance in every movement of the symphony of the melody that begins the first allegro. The passage from this state of melancholic reverie, interrupted by a few fits of unmotivated joy, to one of delirious passion, with its movements of fury and jealousy, its return of tenderness, its tears, its religious consolation, all this is the subject of the first movement. End quote. Here is how Berlioz describes Part 2, a ball. The artist finds himself in the most varied situations, in the midst of the tumult of a festivity, in the peaceful contemplation of the beauties of nature. But wherever he is, in the city, in the country, the beloved image appears before him and troubles his soul. Part 3, Scene in the Fields. Finding himself in the country at evening, the artist hears in the distance two shepherds piping a herding tune in dialogue. This pastoral duet, The scenery, the quiet rustling of the trees gently disturbed by the wind, certain hopes he has recently found reason to entertain, all these come together in giving his heart an unaccustomed calm and in giving brighter color to his ideas. He reflects upon his isolation. He hopes that soon he will no longer be alone. But what if she were deceiving him? This mixture of hope and fear, these ideas of happiness disturbed by black presentiments, form the subject of the adagio. At the end, one of the shepherds again takes up the herding song. The other no longer replies. The distant sound of thunder, solitude, silence. End quote. Berlioz claimed that he wrote the fourth movement in a single night. Part 4, March to the Scaffold. Having become certain that his love goes unrecognized, the artist poisons himself with opium. The dose of the narcotic, too weak to kill him, plunges him into a sleep accompanied by the most horrible visions. He dreams that he has killed the woman he had loved, that he is condemned, led to the scaffold, and that he is witnessing his own execution. The procession moves forward to the sounds of a march that is now somber and fierce, now brilliant and solemn, in which the muffled noise of heavy steps gives way, without mediation, to the most noisy clangor. Finally, here is how Berlioz describes Part 5, The Dream of a Witch's Sabbath. The artist sees himself at the Sabbath, in the midst of a frightful assembly of ghosts, sorcerers, monsters of every kind, all come together for his funeral. Strange noises, groans, outbursts of laughter, distant cries which other cries seem to answer. The beloved melody appears again, but it has lost its character of nobility and reticence. Now, it is no more than the tune of an ignoble dance, trivial and grotesque. It is she come to join the Sabbath, a roar of joy at her arrival. She takes part in the devilish orgy. Funeral knell, burlesque parody of the Dies Irae, Sabbath round dance, the Sabbath round and the Dies Irae combined. This is where Berlioz leaves the world, both musical and actual, behind. Whether or not he actually tried to poison himself with opium over Harriet has never been determined, although the idea that he might have is one of the reasons she agreed to marry him. Leonard Bernstein was convinced as well. He called it music's first expression of psychedelia, saying, "Berlioz tells it like it is. You take a trip, you wind up screaming at your own funeral." Whatever it was that opened the doors of perception to him, it also threw open the gates of musical expression. However deeply he was in debt to Beethoven, Berlioz's fantastic symphony sounds and behaves like nothing ever heard before. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.